U.S. Airways A320 ditches in the Hudson, Eclipse continues through bankruptcy, and the British come up with a rather creative way to protest Heathrow runway expansion plans. This news, including an interview with Kevin Michaels of Aero Strategy on episode 31 of the Airplane Geeks podcast. Welcome back, everybody. This is episode 31 of the Airplane Geeks. We are the Airplane Geeks. I am Courtney. With me, as always, is Max. Good evening, Max.
Hello, Court. Hello, everybody.
And joining us this week, we're very excited to bring Kevin Michaels. He's a partner and co-founder of Aero Strategy, an aerospace consultancy, with offices in Ann Arbor, London, and Singapore. And Kevin has also worked with leading OEMs such as Rockwell Collins and Williams International. Tonight, he is on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Kevin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
A ton of things that have happened in the last week in aviation. And one, maybe we could consider naval aviation. So what do you say we jump into it?
All right, let's do it.
First up on our news this week, this comes from tipsfromthelist.com, the top five mainstream travel blogs. They've picked their top five mainstream travel blogs. Number one on the list is Chris Elliott, the Ultimate Travel Ombudsman. Number two is Peter Greenberg. He's a well-known figure in the travel media world, CNBC, MSNBC, Forbes, The New Yorker. Number three, The Cranky Flyer.
Our buddy,
Brett Snyder. And congratulations to him. They say Brett Snyder's blog is the go-to spot for all the dirty details on the world of air travel. Having spent years on the inside of the industry, Brett brings a balanced perspective as both an advocate of air travelers and as someone who understands the real challenges faced by the industry. He also just clearly loves planes and plane travel, and his enthusiasm comes through in his blogging. I agree. Max, I don't know about you.
Yeah, he's the second one of the five on my own personal list, actually.
Number four was Intelligent Travel, which is National Geographic's traveler's blog. Number five is Jaunted. Say they master the art of glossy magazine-style blog, the traditional travelogue or destination profile. So those are the top five. Cranky Flyer fits in at number three. Congratulations to Brett once again. They also go on to mention some notable mentions. Ben Mutzbah, of course, he writes Today in the Sky blog at USA Today. And he also mentions one of our other guests, Randy Peterson, of Inside Flyer.
Yeah, Inside Flyer, that's one of my personal favorites. You know, Brett Snyder's Cranky Flyer, obviously, and Chris Elliott's blog also. These guys have a lot of good content, competently written. And if you're just sort of interested in the aviation angle of travel, those are three good ones.
And we might also throw in the Airplane Geeks podcast is a great place for that too.
We didn't make the list.
No, we did not make the list. Probably because we're not so much a blog as we are a podcast and not as famous.
Yet.
Okay. Moving on to our next story, the big story of the aviation industry this week from the Associated Press, Hudson River plane skirted disaster at many turns. This is kind of a follow-up article with some more detailed information since this did happen a couple days ago, but unless you've been living under a log, you will know that an Airbus A320 with U.S. Airways paint experienced a bird strike. Actually, that's not entirely true. Experienced multiple bird strikes, which I think they said were geese, lost both engines, and ditched the airplane in the Hudson. Everybody survived.
Yeah, which is very unusual.
Very unusual, seeing as I'm pretty sure this is the first time an A320 has been ditched. This article points out some interesting things about the crew and the events that happened. Some things I wanted to point out here. It started with a wild stroke of misfortunate events after the plane left LaGuardia on Thursday for Charlotte. While bird strikes are common, commercial jet engines are fortified against them. They seldom disable an engine, let alone two. This all from Archie Dickey from Embry-Riddle. He says, bird strikes that cripple both engines are extremely rare, and I have to agree entirely with that. Another interesting point from the article, the pilot, who was Chelsea B. Sullenberger, could have hardly been better prepared. The 58-year-old former fighter pilot was named best aviator in his class at the Air Force Academy, had flown for U.S. Airways for 29 years, and mastered glider flying. He also has investigated air disasters, even studying how airline crews behave in a crisis. I couldn't imagine anybody flying for U.S. Airways that would be better equipped for what happened.
Yeah, absolutely. Court, when you were flying, did you have any experience with any bird strikes personally?
Well, we'd hit birds all the time, which is why this is so extraordinary. I've never hit a flock of geese. I've never lost an engine. I've never even heard firsthand of an aircraft losing an engine. You know, of course it does happen. But to lose two, I mean, geese are large birds, so it seems possible.
Sure, well, you got to have at least one go through each engine, I suppose.
At least, right? Yeah, especially on that aircraft.
Yeah, the smaller birds is not generally too big a problem with respect to the engines. Geese are something altogether. I imagine, Kevin, you might have seen the results of a bird as large as a goose going through a jet engine before.
Well, my old days as a gas turbine engineer, you learn very quickly that bird strike is one of the first design parameters of an engine, where you have to work with a fan to deal with bird strikes. And my first day on the job at Williams International, an OEM, a small propulsion OEM, I wandered down to the shop, and I saw some birds actually running around, and asked naively kind of what were they for, and I later found out, you know, now these days when they develop new engines, they actually test them by launching frozen birds into the engines with a cannon.
Don't make friends with those birds. They won't be around too long, right?
Yeah.
this guy as well, the pilot as well, was CEO of a company called Safety Reliability Methods, Inc., that provides safety strategies for a variety of industries, including aviation. So, like many pilots, he had a business on the side, but this business actually focused on safety. So, to your point, there couldn't be a more qualified or prepared person for this.
Yeah, there was a little discussion on Twitter earlier today, where someone raised the question: you think we'll ever know how much of this was due to skill, how much to luck, and how much to cooperation? Because there really, that was another component of this, I think, between cooperation of the passengers and the crew, cooperation with the ferries and other boats that that responded within a few minutes. And I don't think we will ever know, how much of it was each of those three components. But my comment back was, if you've got one of the three, either luck or skill or cooperation, look for the other two, because when you've got all three, sometimes that's exactly what you need.
A nice little end note to this story. Most passengers emerged with only bruises. However, one flight attendant suffered a severe cut on her leg. Not a bad result for an airplane that, unless I'm missing something, has never been ditched. And wing-mounted engines on airplanes and water don't necessarily make for happy endings. Okay, moving on to our next story, this from Forbes. Our good friend Eclipse fails to draw bids, ET IRC sale likely. Eclipse Aviation Corporation will not be put up for public auction this week after the troubled Albuquerque jet manufacturer failed to attract any qualified bids by Tuesday's deadline. Says Guider, he's a partner with Eclipse's law firm, says there will be no auction. The lack of bids allows Eclipse's largest shareholder, Luxembourg-based ETIRC Aviation, to move ahead with plans to purchase the company.
Yeah, their affiliate, Eclipse Jet Aviation International, is the organization that would purchase Eclipse through a combination of cash, I guess $28 million in cash, and they would issue $160 million in new notes, and there's also a 15% equity in the company that the senior secured note holders would get. Now, for that sale to go through, since there will be no auction, apparently, the U.S. bankruptcy judge has got to approve the sale. And there was originally a hearing scheduled for this past Friday on that proposed sale, but I see that it's actually been continued until Tuesday of this week because there were apparently, according to the AP, dozens of objections to the sale that were on the agenda, and that was according to court documents. So we'll see what happens.
Funding and financing for the sale includes up to $205 million loan from the Russian Federation Bank for Development and Foreign Economic Affairs. If you'll remember, Russian participation in the financing reflects Eclipse's plans to build an assembly line site in Ulyanovsk, Russia. Apparently, Eclipse wants to supply Europe through this Russian plant and the Americas and Asia through their American plant.
Just what Eclipse needs, a second production facility.
Yeah.
That's right.
You're absolutely right.
What do we know about the debt holders and the equity holders on this? Isn't there nearly $1 billion in debt? And who will feel the pain from this bankruptcy?
Well, and you've got a lot of customers with deposits down who stand to lose all that. And if there is in fact a going forward company, then they're going to have to, I would think, do something so that future customers aren't reluctant to put their money down if they have no assurance that they're going to get an airplane out of it.
Yeah. I mean, easing or eliminating that $1 billion or so of debt, trying to amortize that on the sale of these aircraft, getting rid of that will certainly give them some breathing space, although they face huge headwinds in the current market environment. I also wonder, too, with their product support network, they've just begun to build that out, and they have two or three service centers, but by no means a global network as well. And
right.
One wonders for future customers that depend on that kind of thing what Eclipse will do there as well. But they need another production facility, like they need a hole in the head, but it sounds like they need capital even more.
Yeah, that's it. I think you hit the nail on the head there, Kevin. I mean, it's all about capital, and if that means building whatever it is, a $200 million facility for $500 million in capital, then I guess you do it. But you're right. They need it like they need a hole in the head. And you kind of brought up an interesting point that we've alluded to but never really explored, and that's the ability of the manufacturer to support the aircraft, both in maintenance, customer support, and that, and how that affects the customer's purchase, and how much of an uphill battle Eclipse has versus, say, an established manufacturer such as Cessna with their Mustang.
Yeah, it's very important, actually. And if for those that go back and look at the brief history of Dayjet operating the Eclipses, and Dayjet, of course, was the ill-fated air taxi operator in Florida.
Right.
And at one time, I don't have the exact numbers, but I think Dayjet had something like 28 Eclipses, of which something like 13 or 14 were actually operating. And there were problems with parts availability and certification and the like. But comparing, if I can buy an Eclipse for 2.3 million is I think the latest, and I compare that to a Mustang for 2.6, 2.7 million with the Cessna product support network behind it, that is not a very big price differential given the given what you get and given the certainty of the product support, which in Cessna's case is absolutely world-class. That's not a very big differential, whereas when Eclipse began, of course, we were at, south of 900,000 price point versus a little over 2 million for the Mustang. So that gap has been dramatically narrowed. And it's interesting, my firm Aerostrategy, we actually analyzed where the VLJs have gone to date. You know, what types of customers have actually taken delivery of these early Mustangs and Eclipses? And it's kind of interesting. We found that we analyzed a little bit over the 200 of the Eclipses that have been delivered, but about half go to owner-operators, about 30% to corporate flight departments, and then the rest to charter, training, and other. Whereas with the Mustang, it's a much more balanced cross-section of customers. You have corporate flight departments nearly 30%, but then you have charter operators up near 30%, and owner-operators were less than 30%. So there's a big difference in the demographics. A lot of owner-operators buying Eclipses with the low price points. And by the way, owner-operators are obviously highly vulnerable in an economic downturn or crisis like we're having now.
Right, sure.
Do you think the owner-operators were more susceptible to, say, the marketing hype, and perhaps the corporate flight departments maybe knew that $900,000 price tag on a VLJ wasn't sustainable?
I think the owner-operators were highly sensitive to the value proposition, which at the beginning was outstanding of getting a jet aircraft for less than $1 million. So I think that spurred many owner-operators to upgrade from turboprops, you know, to get into jets for the first time and the like. But now the pricing is up north of $2 million, very close to the Mustang, and it's a very, very different situation. And a lot of these owner-operators that had, you know, significant personal net wealth have seen that go away, combined with the troubles of recent days. So it suggests that this big backlog that the new owners are banking on is going to be very, very troubled, going forward, in a way that maybe the Mustang, which will also see difficulties, but not to the same extent.
The problems that Eclipse has gotten into with the VLJ program, do you think that Eclipse itself will have ultimately a positive effect on the VLJ industry as bringing it up, creating it? Or do you think that their demise would have been more of a hindrance to an industry that would have happened regardless?
That's a great question. And I actually, I know it's very popular to pile on Eclipse and Vern Rayburn and everything else, but I actually take a slightly contrarian viewpoint, and I believe that Eclipse has done the industry a big favor. And I recognize that marketing hype and the loss of $1 billion, which if I were a debt holder or an equity holder would be extremely painful, I recognize that that is a major faux pas. But I also believe that what Eclipse did and what Vern Rayburn did, to his credit, is it shook the industry out of complacency at the low end of the market. You know, before Eclipse, you had a CJ2, kind of, you know, the creeping incrementalism at Cessna. You had Hawker 400 with GT15s, very heavy, not very efficient. There was not a lot of innovation going on at the light end of the market. And what Vern forced the industry to do, and it forced Cessna to respond with the Mustang. And, you know, before Eclipse, you know, in today's dollars, the lowest business jet was about $4 million. The price point today is now in the low twos. So Vern caused the industry to innovate, create a new value proposition that made it more accessible to a broader market. And I would also add to that he also did something important in the systems and propulsion part of the market. I mean, he forced and ultimately brought about, initially went with Williams, but eventually Pratt Canada, but it's forced Pratt Canada now to produce jet engines, corporate jet engines at price points that they never imagined, at volumes they never imagined. And so I think it's done actually a great service to the small propulsion industry in spurring innovation there, and I come out of that part of the world in my career. And I think also the avionics side, he's really brought integrated avionics, low-cost avionics into the market in a broad way. yes, he began with Avedine, and eventually now it's really Garmin that dominates down there. But integrated avionics suites at very low price points are now in the market. So I think he's done a great favor for the industry. And today, regardless if Eclipse goes away or not and we're left with a couple hundred aircraft out here, we have the Phenom 100, we have the Mustang, and we may well have the HondaJet as well. So I think that's an important legacy. Not forgiving what he did to the bondholders and debt holders.
Okay, moving into our next story, which is still related to Eclipse in a nice little way, and that's effort underway to remove aviation restriction from rescue package. This is from AOBA Online. The U.S. House of Representatives has removed a provision regarding the divestiture of private aircraft and imposing limits on future aircraft ownership by businesses receiving federal bailout funds through the Troubled Asset Relief Program. The amendment striking the language from the bill followed concerns from numerous aviation organizations, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and lawmakers from aviation-dependent states, including Kansas. General Aviation contributes more than $150 billion to the U.S. economy annually and employs more than 1.2 million people.
You know, there's always special interest groups. You know, people are always interested in you know, looking out for themselves. But, you know, just the idea that, you know, somehow, you know, business aviation, corporate aviation, you know, was inconsistent with a well-run company is just mind-boggling. That even started is, I find, very amazing.
You know, I'm based here in Ann Arbor, not too far from Detroit, and, of course, we've been right in the middle of this whole firestorm about business aviation and the uproar about the CEOs of the big three automakers going
right
to Washington. And so here we are now in the state with the highest unemployment in the country, 10%, and we're closing down two flight departments, Ford and GM, actually fairly large, substantial flight departments. I think 150 jobs are going to go away. I think it's 8 jets that are going to be sold. You know, and as if Rick Wagner is going to sit in seat 13E on Northwest Airlines going down to Washington to prepare for his meeting, you know.
Yeah, that's not going to happen.
That's not going to happen. What's he going to do? So he drives a hybrid, and he ends up spending 24 hours both ways. And what is that worth? So I totally agree. There's a lot of ignorance out there.
Yeah, and what's going to happen is, you know, they're just going to see their charter expenses skyrocket, their airline expenses skyrocket to much more than they were ever paying through the corporate flight department. But what does this, and I don't necessarily mean the retraction of the restriction, but the public perception, what does this mean for corporate flight departments? And kind of in a roundabout way, what does it mean for charter flight departments?
Well, it's certainly not good for corporate flight departments, and I have heard anecdotally of other flight departments, other corporations that were possibly looking at closing down their flight departments as well, as they get hauled up in front of shareholders and boards with this kind of this emotional reaction. So it just adds to the headwinds that has suddenly, you know, emerged for business aviation in the last 4 months. And it's ironic because the U.S. is the home of business aviation. It's where 70% of the world's business jet fleet resides. And in most cases, we've been educating the rest of the world on the utility of business aviation. And, you know, Europe has now started coming around, European countries, where they accept it as a tool of productivity. And it's now, you know, spreading the Middle East and Asia. And last year, half of the business aviation sales were from outside the U.S., which was considered a real bellwether. So just as this happens, now there is this populist reaction in the U.S., you know, against business aviation. So not good indeed. And with the charters, and one would think it's going to help the charters, but I recall seeing, I think in some of the congressional subcommittees, they were talking about trying to include charter in this as well. It didn't make it in the bill, but they were actually talking about that as well, which really, so what does that mean? No charter, no corporate aviation. I guess Mr. Wagner is going to be in seat 13E on Northwest.
Yeah, maybe after all.
Okay, and moving into some issues overseas, and a nice little segue from Kevin as he talked about Europe. This from the LA Times. Activists buy plot to halt Heathrow Airport expansion. And the award for best stalling tactic goes to a coalition of environmentalists, scientists, and actors, including two-time Oscar winner Emma Thompson, who are determined to scupper plans by the British government to build a new runway for Heathrow Airport. The motley crew has bought a small plot, about an acre in size, in the heart of the development area where an extra runway would be situated. The group vows to subdivide the property into hundreds, perhaps thousands, of smaller parcels and sell them off to environmental activists around the world in an effort to bog down the government if it tries to buy up or seize the land. I have to say it's at least creative.
It's very clever.
Does the UK have eminent domain?
Yes. Yeah, the British government has powers of eminent domain. They could force the property owners to sell it if they want to go ahead with the airport extension for that third runway. And I believe after that article came out, that's exactly what they did.
This from Emma Thompson. I don't understand how any government remotely serious about committing to reversing climate change can even consider these ridiculous plans. It's laughably hypocritical. We'll stop this from happening even if we have to move in and plant vegetables.
Vegetables.
A refuting Member of Parliament, Brian Wilson, says, if anti-aviation groups are really serious about climate change, they would be engaging in constructive dialogue with the industry about how we can protect the economic and social benefits it brings whilst dealing with its environmental impact. Instead, they seem more interested in PR stunts with eco-celebrities. This seems a little over the top, huh?
Yeah, there's some strong forces here, and we'll get into it a little bit with our next piece, I think, on the future of aviation. But yeah, the green movement or the environmental movement, for good and legitimate reasons, I think, has some serious concerns about this industry as well as some others. And you also have the needs of the industry and the needs of the traveling public that looks for growth and expansion, and the two come to loggerheads at times, and that's what we're seeing here. Both viewpoints at times are, I'll say, kind of extreme, in my opinion. And what I don't see is a lot of kind of search for the middle ground. Clearly we don't want our industry, the aviation industry, to destroy the environment, but we have to find a way to make it work all around.
They have to stand up against it, right? They have to, because it's what they do. But you're really kind of pushing back against an industry that has been doing a lot to improve its environmental signature. But on the other hand, something as extreme as this kind of makes those middle of the road environmental improvements not seem so crazy. Does that make sense?
I know what you're saying.
So by being crazy, it kind of makes everything else look not so crazy.
Look moderate, sure. Yeah, sure. I mean, it's all about carbon emissions these days, and I don't really know for sure if that's the one single measure of environmental impact that makes sense and is broadly applicable. But whether it is or isn't, the movements have latched onto that. We see, schemes for trading carbon credits and, creating markets in that for that kind of commodity, if you want to call it that. And that's what I think these groups are focused on. They're looking at the carbon emissions from aircraft, and they see that it's not insignificant, and they want to do something about it.
Now, a suggestion to the environmentalist groups, if there are any that are listening to our podcast, may I suggest going to Max's very first pick of the week on episode one? That's treeflights.com.
That's right. We have a tree planted.
That's right. We do have a tree planted in Airplane Geek's name. So there's a little retro pick of the week for you.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's interesting, too. The industry, aviation, just has not done a good job of promoting what it has done in fuel efficiency and carbon emissions over the years as well. And while it's easy to sit back and say that aviation contributes, you know, just 2% to global warming, it's a visible target. It's an easy target. You know, other sources of emissions like buildings, heating buildings is 15%. You know, it's how can you protest an inefficient homeowner that doesn't have, you know, the 2 feet of insulation in their attic? That's hard, but airports are easy to protest. And so it's a visible target, and it's an easy to identify target, you know, that fits into the environmental movement. And the aviation industry has been caught on its heels. It's been reactive, and it hasn't been proactive in getting out and telling the story about the dramatic increases of fuel efficiency that have occurred over the last 30 years, and actually what's in store over the next 10 to 15 years. And, you know, it's interesting, if in Europe, you know, probably the one thing more than anything that could reduce greenhouse gas emissions would be single sky air traffic control, which could, if they could get their act together on air traffic control, it could reduce emissions by itself 15% for the entire European airline industry. So, ironically, the green movement may actually push Europe towards single sky air traffic control.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right.
I agree. Moving into our last story, and this is kind of a compilation of everything that we've been talking about. This from publicservice.co.uk, special report, The Future of Aviation. And what they did in this article was interview a number of top executives and agency heads about their views of what are the major issues that need to be looked at in the future, specifically in 2009. Most of us accept the need for reduced carbon emissions, new technologies, and traveling greener. But should we block expansions and encourage alternatives or encourage growth while at the same time investing in research and development? Mary Peters, she's the U.S. Secretary of Transportation, speaks to the need to develop competition in industry to ensure that passengers get a better deal. While Peter Lockley, he's the head of the WWF UK, that's the World Wildlife Foundation, claims that as growth of the aviation industry runs counter to the government's environmental policies, it should drop all plans to expand the UK's airports. So again, we're into some kind of competing opinions here. Barry Humphreys, he's the Director of External Affairs and Route Development at Virgin Atlantic, believes the strategy would be highly detrimental to economic growth. That is in response to Peter Lockey of the WWF.
It was interesting to see the diversity of opinions on these issues, and it's not even really differences in, you know, which side these various people take. It's they all look at it, you know, in completely different terms in many cases.
Certainly, the first person interviewed was Mary Peters, the U.S. Secretary of Transportation, and just to kind of give a differing look on the industry and the problems that seem to be affecting the U.S. industry as opposed to what Europe perceives to be its problems. Mary Peters says, reliable transportation is increasingly a challenge for the traveling public. Substantial changes are underway for airlines, especially as they find ways to offset rising fuel costs. She goes on to talk about the slot auction. She says, I don't begrudge an industry's efforts to protect its interests, but my business is protecting consumers, fostering competition, and providing reliable travel. Moreover, independent economic experts of all political stripes agree that slot auctions or congestion pricing is far preferable to the status quo. I wonder how many of those independent economic experts belong to an airline.
Yeah.
Specifically one in Houston.
Yeah.
So kind of interesting difference of opinion from, you know, the issues going on in the UK, which we've been talking about, as opposed to, you know, what we're worried about here in the States is on time.
Yeah, Mary Peters takes a very, classic position with respect to having the pricing mechanism determine all these issues, and in some cases I think letting a a legitimate market force determine the direction, you know, can work. But I think the issues here are a little bit more complicated than that.
I agree, and this is kind of a new topic for us on tonight's podcast, and that's really the slot auctions, which we haven't talked about in a while.
You know, as I read all this, I'm wondering, what's the forum for working through these issues? I mean, you've got Mary Peters, the DOT, or rather the Secretary of Transportation, Professor of Atmospheric Science, Roderick Jones, the WWF, the British Environmental Agency, all these different people with all these, you know, interesting thoughts and ideas. And what's the forum for working through this? Is there a forum that can help the industry navigate through these waters?
You know, in theory, clearly IATA, the International Air Transport Association, should at least be the unified voice representing operators, and ICAO, you know, brings together the governments to talk about this. But in practice, it is very patchy, and it's a quilt work of different organizations and interest groups. And, you know, if you just look at what's driving the carbon emissions taxes on aviation in Europe, I think that's coming out of the European Commission and not out of these international organizations. So Europe is driving it, and everyone else is responding, including IATA and including the various interests in this country. It's interesting. I saw Mary Peters speak last year, and she's very much, you know, against carbon taxes and really wants to use alternative approaches to this. But I just get the feeling that we're not we're on a completely different wavelength. We, the U.S., completely different wavelength from Europe. And if we do not find a way to communicate and get on the same wavelength and negotiate, then we are going to have regulations, you know, imposed upon us.
Right, right.
We have not been part of the debate, and hopefully that's something that may change with the new administration.
Sure. Sounds like we need some leadership to engage in that debate. We need some leadership to take these fragmented interests and bring them together. Otherwise, it's just continued squabbling.
Absolutely, and I would add to that the airlines, you know, whether it's IATA or elsewhere, need to devote a little bit of budget to public relations to talk about the great things that this industry has been doing over the years. And the public, I believe, the average consumer, the average voter, the average even environmental activist are not aware of what has happened in this industry with regards to fuel efficiency and carbon emissions and the like.
Yeah, I agree completely.
Well said. Okay, moving into our main topic, and again, we're talking with Kevin Michaels. He's partner and co-founder of Aero Strategy, an aerospace consultancy with offices in Ann Arbor, London, and Singapore. Kevin has worked with leading OEMs such as Rockwell Collins and Williams International. Kevin, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Before we started the podcast, we were kind of discussing some of the things that you do. And the first that came up that you tend to be the expert in is MRO. Could you kind of give us a background to that? As we haven't spoken about MRO or any maintenance, to be quite honest with you, on the podcast before.
Sure. MRO stands for Maintenance, Repair, and Overhaul. And the reason that the Maintenance, Repair, and Overhaul, I guess what I want to talk about is Maintenance, Repair, and Overhaul in the context of it, you know, the economic contribution to the industry, not as much as it relates to safety, although we can talk about that. But most capital goods industries out there today, whether you're talking about cars, planes, trains, heavy equipment, the nature of capital goods has changed over the last 30 or 40 years, where service has become a more fundamental element of the mix if you're a manufacturer. And I think many of us may be familiar with the story of IBM and about how Lou Gerstner came in and transformed the company from just providing mainframe computers and PCs to a major service company where services are 40 and 50% of the revenue. Well, the same thing has really happened in aviation. And as you mentioned, our firm, Aerostrategy, has done a lot of work in this area, and we've actually estimated how much is spent on aircraft maintenance. And this year, we estimate that $117 billion will be spent by operators on maintenance, repair, and overhaul. And those operators take many different forms. They could be airlines. They could be business aviation operators. They could be governments operating military aircraft. But $117 billion, to put that in context, this year, according to the Teal Group, the value of aircraft production will be $116 billion. So there is actually as much money spent on maintenance as there is on production. Now, why is that important? Well, for most manufacturers, they make the lion's share of their profits from the aftermarket, from selling service parts, from selling specialized repairs, or providing other services to operators. And as we talked about earlier in the VLJ segment, customer support and maintenance is a key element of satisfaction if you're going to buy one aircraft versus another. You know, in the early days, product support was an Achilles heel of Airbus in the 70s and 80s, and it was a major competitive advantage for Boeing. Airbus closed that gap, you know, in the 90s and then helped them sell aircraft. So MRO is a major global business. It is a key element of profits, and it is one of the most global parts of aviation. Most people don't realize this, but there's this organization out there called the World Trade Organization, which governs trade of goods and services. And aviation is largely excluded from the WTO. Otherwise, you know, Richard Branson could come to America and form an airline unhindered by other types of regulation or obstacles. So that part's out of it. Aviation itself is not global. I would argue it's multinational. But MRO is one of the few parts of aviation included in the World Trade Organization. So what it means is that if I'm an OEM like Pratt, an original equipment manufacturer like Pratt & Whitney, and I want to establish a maintenance base in Turkey, and Turkey's part of the WTO, I can go there, set up a maintenance base, and I cannot be discriminated against in doing that. So it's become very, very global. So those are the reasons why it's important. You know, in terms of that $117 billion, about half of that's military. The world's airlines today spend about $45 billion on maintenance. You know, the air travel business today is about $500 billion. So a typical airline spends 8, 9, 10% of their cost structure on maintenance, but it's one of the areas that they can control cost in, as opposed to something like fuel, where you're at the whims, you know, of the market. So it tends to be an area that gets a great deal of focus. And given the fact that these aircraft are in service for 30 and 40 years, and sometimes much longer than that, and the importance of safety, of course, you know, maintenance ends up being a very, very huge deal.
Kevin, you mentioned that maintenance is something that is an expense that the airlines can control to a certain extent. Are we seeing airline behavior with respect to MRO changing as a result of the economic situation?
Yes, we are. Yes, we are. I think the most fundamental change that we need to talk about is just the notion of what is core to the, how much maintenance activity should be core to the airline. And most airline business models, if you look back over the last 10 or 15 or 20 years, it really evolved out of the era of cost plus. I know you had Alfred Kahn on last week, and
yes.
the era before deregulation. You know, if you're an airline and you wanted to build a big maintenance hangar, that may not have been economical or it may not have always made sense, but you could pass that cost on the consumer. At that time, back in the 60s, 50s, 70s, most airlines were fairly self-sufficient in maintenance. They did pretty much everything themselves. They built big engine test facilities for jet engines. They had major hangars to do structural maintenance on the aircraft, to do component maintenance. They invested heavily in test equipment, and they were mostly self-sufficient. Deregulation comes along in the U.S. in the late 70s, and the winds of competition really get brewing in the 80s. And at the same time, what starts to happen is maintenance suppliers around the world start to become a bit more global. They start to organize a little bit more. And really, this was led by the big manufacturers like the Boeings and the Pratt & Whitneys and the General Electrics and Rolls-Royces that started building out global service networks to maintain their engines and their aircraft and the like. So what airlines began to do increasingly, especially in the 90s and in this decade, is they began to outsource maintenance. And they first looked at the activities that maybe were uneconomical for them to do in an environment where they were in price competition. So they started looking first at engine overhaul. Do we really need to maintain our own jet maintenance facility? Or could we go to someone like Pratt & Whitney or General Electric, the manufacturer of the engine, or a major independent supplier? So they began to outsource that. And more recently, they began to outsource heavy maintenance. Heavy maintenance is the structural maintenance on the aircraft. It's labor-intensive. It's about 75% labor. And what happened after 2001, the recession in the U.S. in 2001 and the bankruptcy of several airlines, is they pretty much started closing down hangars. So one of the big ones was United Airlines had a major facility in Indianapolis, which they pulled out of. They curtailed their activities in San Francisco, which is arguably, you know, one of the most expensive places in the world to do aircraft maintenance. Northwest pulled back from maintenance. U.S. Airways did as well. And they began outsourcing, you know, more and more of this maintenance. So I would say that outsourcing has been certainly probably the key change in the behavior of airlines and maintenance in recent years. And it's not without controversy. Labor unions, you know, don't like this. They're opposed to it. And there are actually some political issues brewing these days, you know, that are trying to prevent sourcing of maintenance from foreign countries.
We are going a little long. So in the interest of time, I do want to make sure that we're able to put you through the same torture that we put all our other guests through. And that's with award associations. We appreciate you playing along. Max, do you have your three?
Yes, I do. Kevin, and you can just, you know, say whatever comes into your mind when you hear our words. First one I have is composites MRO.
Composites MRO. Skill shortage.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're not teaching that. We're still teaching old technology in our trade schools, and composites are becoming a bigger part of aviation, and with aircraft like 787, you know, soon to come out, and we have a skill shortage there right now.
Okay, my first word, and I apologize if I get this wrong. I heard you say it. It's the first I've heard of it, but single sky.
European air traffic management, I guess I would say. 15% emissions reduction. That would be my response.
That says it all right there.
Yeah, absolutely. Next I have next generation ATC funding.
Difficult and sometimes impossible. Especially in the U.S. We need the Greens to push this through Congress.
Okay, Kevin, my next word, bird strike.
Thick fan. Thick fan.
More
that's
metal.
What you need. That's what you need to deal with it. Thick fan, you know, is from the jet engine perspective.
Now, there are videos on YouTube. I've seen them somewhere. I think they're on YouTube, of these bird ingestion tests.
Yeah.
And they're fast. Hopefully I can find one to attach on the blog with the episode. But the amount of flex in these fans and the amount of birds that they're taking while the engine continues to run is really spectacular.
It is spectacular, and jet engine designers will tell you that, when you're looking at a new jet engine design, this is one of the first issues that have to be dealt with. And GE came out with a new engine, 10 years ago, called the GE90. It's kind of probably the most popular wide-body engine. It's on the 777 and so forth, and it's got a composite fan, and there was worry, well, could it handle bird strikes? Well, it turns out that it can, but it affects the spacing of the fan blade, the part of the jet engine you see when you look in the nacelle. It affects the materials that you use, the thickness. It's a very integral part of that whole design process. But if the fan survives and parts of the bird get back, that's the stuff that's harder to deal with. It sounds like some of that's part of what happened.
Yeah, what'll be key is whether the result was reduced thrust or no thrust.
Exactly.
If you have airfoils liberated as a result of the strike, and if they'll then pass through the engine, they'll just take out all the remaining stages of the engine, and they'll result in what is affectionately known in the industry as a corn cob. So, okay, I have one left, right, Court? Is that the score?
That's the score.
Two. I have one left. Okay, my last one, industry re-regulation.
Highly unlikely.
Good.
highly unlikely. And these calls by Bob Crandall earlier last year talking about how we need to re-regulate industry, I think are ridiculous. And I would argue that this industry, if you look at global service industries, whether it's telecommunications or McDonald's or hotels or anything else, there are only a few service industries left on the planet that are regulated to the extent that aviation is today. I think it's aviation and maritime shipping, where it's illegal. I mean, this industry right now needs capital, and it probably needs some forms of consolidation. And it can't happen right now because of the cabotage laws, the laws that prevent foreign operators from flying flights in the U.S., and the foreign ownership restrictions, which prohibit foreigners from owning more than 49% of stock of a U.S. airline. To me, it's absolutely ridiculous that in 2008 that this is in place. If you go and you stay at a Hyatt hotel or a Hilton hotel, do you know who owns that? Is it a U.S. owner or someone else? Do you care? Do you care that Burger King is owned by a British company? I mean, as long as the U.S. regulatory, the safety, FAA and others, OSHA, regulate safety, what does it matter who owns it? And especially in an era where we're starving for capital, it limits us to just capital in the U.S. So I'm on my soapbox, and I'll step off it now so you can end the podcast. But I think the problem here isn't that we need to re-regulate. The problem is we have not appropriately deregulated this industry. We probably have too many airlines in the world.
Okay, the last word then, airplane geeks.
Good fun. I appreciate you having me and delving into mundane issues like MRO, but hopefully it rounds out the picture a little bit in this industry that we all know and love.
Kevin, we appreciate you joining us.
Okay, thank you very much.
A big thanks to Kevin Michaels of AeroStrategy. Now Max has his pick of the week.
Yeah, my pick this week is an outfit called Planehook Aviation Services. They're at planehook.com. That's Planehook. These guys are kind of experts in general aviation security and actually now the new space tourism field. And they provide aviation security program risk assessments and acquisition assistance and also specialized aviation consulting. They're kind of all about effective, low-cost security solutions for general aviation. Now, besides all that, and the reason for them being my pick this week, is they have a series of interesting webcasts, including a few on the TSA large aircraft security program proposals that we've been talking about in a few of the past podcasts. Now, you'll find these webcasts by following the Who is Planehook link, where they have a large number of these webcasts archived, including two so far on that LASP. The technology they use to display the slides and do the audio playback from the webcasts works really well, or if you want, you can just download the MP3 file. So on these two LASP webcasts they've had, they've done one as an overview of the topic, and then the second one is has been a economic analysis of the proposal. And they have a third webcast on this topic coming up on February 3rd, 2009. That's at noon Central Time. So you may want to catch that if this is a topic you're interested in. And their other webcasts cover different security topics for airports and flight schools and corporate aviation. They have a bit of an online presence. They support the Flightline Internet Radio, and they have a Planehook YouTube channel, so they're fairly aware online. And they have some airport security how-to videos and some other interesting information about that. So, again, you can find their website at planehook.com. And if you're interested in aviation security, you'll want to take a look at them, listen to their webcasts, participate if you like. And that's my pick for this week.
Great. We did have a couple listener emails. Well, I should say we did have one and then a comment on the blog that I thought was interesting. The first email came from Mikhail. And Mikhail says, nice to have you back on the air. Happy New Year. Did you know that there were at least 100 airports that closed in the past 2 years as a direct consequence of airline mergers, high fuel costs, and operational costs? The last one closed 2 weeks ago, a few miles away from Spokane. Would you consider airline deregulation as an indirect cause of such inevitable events, I suppose? And that's from Mikhail. And Max and I were talking about this, and I think what Mikhail means by closing airports are the loss of airline service. And, you know, it's interesting because Dr. Khan mentioned this as his one real regret to, you know, airline deregulation, and something that he didn't necessarily foresee as much, and that's the loss of service to these small cities, in which case he fully backed the Essential Air Service program. I think very recently that has either been stopped or scaled back significantly, which is causing these airports to see the loss of service. Max, did you have any comments?
Well, there's other pressures, too. There's a small general aviation airport just down the road from me. The land that it's on is actually owned by the town over there. And the big debate right now is whether or not the town would be better off economically by selling the land for development, putting up houses and businesses and generating, you know, tax revenue from that. So there's an example of, you know, another, you know, kind of threat to, you know, local and regional airports coming from interests that would rather develop them. So it can be a tough time for airports. And, you know, certainly it's part of the infrastructure of this country anyway, that we really want to preserve. We have to understand the economics of them, and even maybe more importantly is make sure that the people who might want to, you know, close down these airports, you know, fully understand the economic benefit to the region of small airports.
Okay, and one other, let's see, a comment that we got on the blog, and this from Gunther. He says, I recall you saying that the HondaJet was innovative because of the engines being overwing. The German VFW 614 already had this design in the 70s, and he included a link to the Wikipedia page, and sure enough, and now I remember the aircraft, it in fact did have the engines above the wings, but I did fail to mention that when we were talking about the aircraft. So thank you, Gunther. Some other feedback that we got from our branding discussion with Shashank Nigam, and that was all on Twitter. some rather lively discussion about those who
think that
branding is a waste of time and those who don't. So that it was very very interesting discussion. If you would like to join in a discussion with us on Twitter, you can follow us either at Airplane Geeks, or you can follow us directly. My Twitter name is Miller22, and Max
is Max Flight.
Also, you can get a hold of us on email, thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Send us an email. Let us know what you think. We also appreciate you leaving a review for us on iTunes, or just mention us in a blog post. We do appreciate that. We also have the voicemail number, 812-757-4252. Give us a call. You can leave a message, and we'll get you on the podcast. Don't forget, as we always say, the best way to support us is by telling your friends.
Absolutely.
So tell them all.
Several times.
Several times. Other than that, please support Flightline Internet Radio. I've been a little lax at getting some of our excerpts to them, so expect some newer content from the Airplane Geeks on Flightline Internet Radio. You can check them out at flightlineinternetradio.com. And don't forget our newsletter. You can sign up for on the right side of our page, our homepage at airplanegeeks.com.
I think that covers it.
I think it does. Thank you once again, Max, for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And I'm going to need a word of wisdom.
A word of wisdom. I guess if anyone is looking for a competent U.S. Airways pilot, I know one just for you.
Same here. So thank you all for joining us. We'll see you next week on episode 32 of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We'll see you guys.
Bye, everybody.
Welcome back, everybody. This is episode one. Excuse me. Wow. I really made it far on that one. Yeah.